I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. There are more students on U.S. college campuses today than ever. But making it to college is one thing, graduating another. High-achieving students from low-income families are graduating at a drastically lower rate than their better-off counterparts. Overall, some 40% of American students who start at four-year colleges still don't have a degree 6 years later. Reasons are complex and can include psychological obstacles as well as financial ones. One of the country's leading educators, UMBC President Freeman Hrabowski, is with us this hour, as is David Lawden, a chemistry professor in Texas who created a program there that has helped lower-income students get a diploma, closing the college achievement gap. It's next on Midday. First, the news from NPR. And good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks for joining us. Here's some good news. There are more young people going to college today than ever. But behind this positive trend lies a sobering reality. High-achieving American students from low-income families might be making it to college, but they're far less likely to graduate. Statistically speaking, only a quarter of college freshmen from the poorest families will graduate with a bachelor's degree by the time they're 24. That compares with 90% of their well-to-do counterparts. Overall, some 40% of American students who start at four-year colleges still don't have a degree 6 years later. What's going on? The reasons behind this trend are complex. When they arrive on campus, poorer students are often grappling with issues such as self-doubt, fear, and feelings of not belonging. They're also more likely to feel overwhelmed by the realities of college life, not to mention that they're dealing with additional financial pressures that can often distract from their coursework. Other obstacles to achievement can include poor study habits and a lack of academic preparedness. As the recent cover story in the New York Times Magazine put it, some students get to a good college and encounter what should be a minor obstacle, and they freak out. They don't want to ask for help, or they don't know how. Things spiral, and before they know it, they're back at home, resentful, demoralized, and in debt. And as you can imagine, the college graduation gap has major implications for society. With me today to get into this topic are two men with a great breadth of experience when it comes to helping college students succeed. One of the country's leading educators, Freeman Hrabowski, is with us in Studio A again. Freeman Hrabowski is president of the University of Maryland at Baltimore County. He's been at the helm of that school for more than 20 years now, and in that time he's had remarkable success at bringing minority students into the fields of science and technology in particular, and getting many of them into graduate school in those fields. Freeman Hrabowski serves as the chair of the President Obama's Advisory Commission on Educational Excellence for African Americans. So thanks for being here today, Freeman. It's nice to see you.
Thank you, Dan, very much.
Also with us is David Lawden. David Lawden is Senior Vice Provost for Enrollment and Graduation Management at the University of Texas at Austin. David Lawden is also a chemistry professor there, and he's crafted an innovative program at the University of Texas, Austin, that's been successful at improving outcomes for low-income students. His program is now becoming a model for other schools, and his work was recently profiled in that New York Times cover story I mentioned, which is why we invited him on to the show. So, David Lawden, thank you very much for joining us here on the Midday Show in Baltimore.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Freeman Hrabowski, let me start with you here. What is your reaction to, first, just the statistics, this trend that we see of students getting into college more than ever, but then a considerable percentage of them not finishing?
Sure. Dan, I have to start by saying that we are very proud at UMBC that we have minority students going on leading the country in producing African-Americans who get science PhDs. But I'm just as proud of the fact that we have students of all races coming to us, 25% of whom are from low-income backgrounds, and seeing them educated across disciplines in the humanities, the social sciences. It's very important to say that. Now, the fact is that we do have more people going to college than ever before. The fact is also that large numbers of those who come to college don't have the academic skills they need when they get there. And the fact is that we as colleges and universities in America have not necessarily thought about all the things we should be doing to give support to people who may be the first in their families to go to college, whether they are students of color or white or whatever, and how we should be monitoring their success, understanding their perceptions about the environment, understanding the obstacles that they face. But there is this need to look at the relationship between their academic preparation and the level of rigor of the coursework and the expectations we have of those students.
David Loudy, at the University of Texas Austin, as a chemistry professor, you were seeing some failures in your classes. You were teaching large classes in chemistry. And so you wanted to take a look there and see what was going on. Why were some students failing? So can you please give us a little of the background here of your involvement in this?
Certainly. I teach a 500-student section chemistry course, and at UT Austin, because of the way admissions works, a certain percentage of students who graduate at the top of their high school class are admitted into the university. That means if they're interested in a STEM field, in science or engineering, for example, they're almost certainly going to be taking my course. This means also that in my class, on that first day, I'll have a wide range of student preparation for the course. This can be measured in a variety of ways, including the SAT. The SAT difference for my class between what is typically the average student with something around a 1200 and a 1250 SAT and that bottom quartile student down around 1000 or 1050 is pretty substantial. And if you look at graduation rates and you consider the SAT as providing at least some hint that students with higher SAT scores will be more likely to graduate, then that means that on the very first day of class, I already know I have a population of students who are less likely to be successful. One question to ask is what they're doing in that class in the first place. But another question to ask is, once they're in that class, do I have a responsibility to them? What I think I've come to realize over the quarter century that I've been teaching is that I do have a responsibility to that student's success. It's easy for me to identify who the kid with a high SAT is so that he or she can get an A on that first test. But why should I turn my back then on that student who does poorly on that first test when I already knew that they were less likely to do so in the first place? So beginning about 15 years ago and evolving as I move forward, I started asking this question. Shouldn't I expect that if I enter into a contract with a student that shows up on my campus and wants to earn a degree over 4 years, shouldn't I expect that I have a responsibility to help that student be successful? That's why I start every semester teaching in that class saying, it's my job to make sure all 500 of you get an A. The question then becomes, how do I make that happen? And to make a long story short, what I found is that if I pulled those students who were in that bottom quartile out, and rather than remediate them or tell them that they didn't belong in that class, if I supplemented substantially, if I provided the appropriate mentoring, tutoring, community building, and I built in that student a sense that they belonged, then I was able to get the same kinds of results out of that student than I was out of the students in the larger population. Even more surprising, they were more likely to stay with STEM and to graduate. And in that first cohort, they graduated at about double the rate of the rest of the class within the college. This led to me to believe that even though, as the president indicates, students do come in sometimes with foundational backgrounds that are an issue, it isn't simply a matter of remediation in ways that separate the students, but it's a matter of saying, is there a way that I can rapidly immerse that student in what it will take to bring them up to a level where they'll be able to be successful? And what we found is that that's the case.
And now you have a whole program laid out in these years since then for looking at and sizing up these students based on what you call adversity indicators, right?
That's correct.
And that includes family background, family income for one thing, SAT scores for another. But I may want to go to Freeman Hrabowski here. It sounds to me like David Loudy, as a chemistry professor with these large class, said, I'm going to make the best of this. Yeah, in Texas, if you're in high school and you finish in the top 7% of your high school graduating class, correct me if I'm wrong, David, you get automatically admitted to this school, and your SAT may only be about 1,000, but I'm a professor, and I feel some obligation
First
to you,
of all,
and I'm going to deal with that.
The 1,000 places that student at a percentile that is fairly unusual for blacks, for example, in your state, David, as you know, even for Hispanics from certain groups. But I would ask you several questions. What is the graduation rate there at Texas Austin right now? What is your graduation rate?
The 4-year graduation rate is about 52%, and overall, the 6-year graduation rate pushes 75 to 80%.
The question, when I look at, I chair the National Academies Committee on Underrepresentation in Science and Engineering, and University of Texas is not one of the leading institutions in producing Blacks or Hispanics who become scientists. What do those graduates do who are finishing in the science areas and the chemistry areas? What do they tend to do?
In fact, most of the students who come from those backgrounds have an interest in medicine. We've seen a shift over the years so that something on the order of 75 or 80% of the minority students who come into the College of Natural Sciences, their intention is to become a physician, to become a nurse, a dentist.
So you're not seeing as one of your goals to produce Hispanic and Black scientists and science professors, chemistry professors?
Oh, not at all.
No, he just wants to see them pass chemistry. Right? No. Am I right?
Now, to be fair about that, we have a program called the Freshman Research Initiative. And this is a program in which we found that bringing about half of our incoming students in the College of Natural Sciences, this is about 1,000 students out of 2,000 students, this is sponsored by HHMI, that if you immerse that student in an experiential learning environment from the moment they arrive on campus, then you're able to change their mind about the idea of becoming active in scientific research, and that this has a significant impact on minority students. You were asking about what happens as a student arrives in college. For the most part, we find that students coming from first-generation backgrounds tend to be less of a mind when they arrive that they want to become a scientist, and they look toward fields like engineering or medicine.
You're absolutely right. And let me commend you on the work that you're doing and on your having the foresight to think about doing things in a different way. I think the reason UMBC has gotten such national visibility for producing minority scientists, so much so that Howard Hughes is now replicating our programs at Penn State and at Chapel Hill, is that we've done just that. From the beginning, students are immersed in research experiences. We're building community. But most important, beyond the minorities, the real question in America is how do we help students of all races, particularly kids from low-income backgrounds, to succeed in college and then to succeed in these disciplines such as STEM? And what we found, whether talking about in STEM or in the humanities or in social sciences, is building community among the students, having close connections with the faculty, getting people involved in course redesign. We've been at UMBC and throughout the University System of Maryland under Britt Curran's leadership. We have been redesigning courses, getting away from simply lecturing and getting students involved in many more activities designed to build relationships among the students, to problem solve, and it has made all the difference in the world. To the extent that students become connected to the work, to each other, and to faculty, they are much more likely to remain and to succeed.
A comment on that. I'm actually coming from a studio where I've been videotaping my entire year-long course over the course of 2 weeks so that I can put it online and create this hybrid course environment. I started this 4 years ago, and what the president refers to is absolutely the case. When I am able to take my content and make it available to the students 24/7 and provide a clear understanding to them of the expectation for what it is that they need to learn from that material, I am now free to not have to simply throw PowerPoint slides up on a screen. In fact, I walk in to class every day, and most of my time is spent with the students, sorting out with them how they should go about being effective in becoming a part of the UT community, in studying well for an exam, in dealing with the challenges that they're going to face as a freshman. It's an enormously liberating opportunity, and it's been responsible for a substantial increase in the number of A's I'm able to give. My grades are getting higher, not because the tests are getting easier, but because I'm free to do the smart things about motivating and incentivizing a student to do well. So the president is quite right. This move towards this kind of hybrid environment is enormously important in the STEM fields.
Let me ask Freeman Hrabowski this, a basic question before we take our first break. And then get your comments and David Loudy's here. This seems a fundamental question. He's dealing with students who come out of the top 7% of their high school graduating classes in public high schools in Texas,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, I mean, would you argue that that's not a good system to have? that students are different, schools are different.
Yes.
Students who get A's and B's may not be doing so well on SATs.
Right, right.
So
that these are factors that need to be considered. When he talked about lower SATs,
this school's at a disadvantage.
I got your point. No. When he talked about SATs, though, you see, when you talk about even 1,000 or 1,050 for a minority kid, that's an unusual score compared to what we see. The average black SAT is in the 800s. So he's got a kid who has worked hard, who has some background. The student does not have the average that he has on his campus. His average is about like ours, in the 1200s for math and verbal. But the fact is that if you've got a student who is above what most have done in grades, and test scores do count. We need to stop telling young people that the tests don't count. When students say to me, when they come in, they want to say, well, why should I worry about the test? I will say, well, if you're going to be a surgeon and somebody's on the operating table, and all of a sudden you tell them you like people and you had good grades, but I can't pass the test, I don't think they want you operating on them. At some point, you have to prove that you know something by standardized measures. So he talked about a difference in the SATs, but he did talk about them having some level of skill. You can't take someone who is at a much lower level, much lower level, and expect them to compete against someone who's had much stronger
backgrounds. When we return from the break, I'll offer up some perspective on that.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you for being aware of our need to take a break here. All right, thank you very much, David Loudy, who's a Senior Vice Provost for Enrollment and Graduation Management at the University of Texas, Austin, and Freeman Hrabowski, President of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, our guest in this hour of midday. If you have a comment or question about what we're discussing, 410-662-8780, the midday email address for comments or questions, midday@wypr.org. I like this is a quote here from the New York Times Magazine piece that we're discussing today. What actually brought us to this subject? It's Paul Tough, who was earlier a guest on the Midday Show, wrote this piece, Who Gets to Graduate? If you want to read it, there's a link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Select the students who are least likely to do well, but in all your communications with them, convey the idea that you have selected them for this special program, not because you fear they will fail, but because you are confident they can succeed. David Loudy, I'm sure you appreciate that quote from Paul Tough, that describing your approach with this program and those students at the University of Texas, Austin.
Yes, it's an interesting question to ask. As President Hrabowski points out, there is some level of expectation in what it is that a test score says about your ability to be successful. And I do appreciate that the quality of the students matriculating at UT Austin continues to rise. But when I started this program, in that initial cohort of 50 students, about half of them had an SAT score under 1,000, and many of them had scores in the 800 range. It is also true that several of those students were able, 4 years later, to go off to medical school, notably to UT Southwestern. I remember working with that cohort and wondering how it was that they could have earned those grades in the first place, those test scores in the first place in high school, and then been able to so substantially turn things around in college. I think a lot of it has to do with what you've just said. When we created the program, my intention with it, and this was the Texas Interdisciplinary Plan, was that the students show up with the attitude that they could be successful. And there was some selectivity here. Yes, they were selected for because they had lower SAT scores, but they were also selected because they were willing to write an essay in which they talked about their intellectual muse and their desires that would come as a consequence of their academic development. Then from the moment they arrived on campus, there was never a thought or a word given to the idea that they were to be remediated, given to the idea that they should be separated or viewed as somehow less capable. The result was that those students were able to demonstrate from the very beginning academic progress. And each of them had a different trajectory that they had to launch from. But most of them were able to get to a place where they were able to mainstream by the end of the first year. I remember talking to one of those young men as he was leaving my office, and he turned and looked at me and he said, you know, I know why I'm in your program. And I said, why is that? And he said, it's because I went to a lousy high school. Now, I don't know whether the high school was lousy, but I know for that student, in his mind, it wasn't him that was the problem. He himself was ready to persevere. He himself was ready to work incredibly hard. And as long as I was willing to be a partnership, be in a partnership with him in doing this, then we would be able to get him to where he needed to go. I think that perspective that the student has, that you believe in them and that they in fact will be successful, is one of the things we absolutely have to make sure students arrive on campus with.
Freeman Hrabowski.
David, you have absolutely the right attitude. It's what I see in my colleagues at UMBC who truly believe that students of all races, from all income levels, can succeed. And I think the theme that we have that really makes a difference is that the life of the mind is very active. We expect students to put in 4, 5, 6 hours a day, and they do, and they work extraordinarily hard. I will say that I want people in the schools to appreciate the need for young people to learn to read and think well, because test scores are heavily connected to, correlated with reading and thinking skills. And too often, particularly in minority communities, we tell children that standardized tests don't count. And that is not a good thing to tell them, because then they don't try hard. Having written the math questions, having taught math for years and years and years, I know that the reading and thinking skills are very important. And the reason I bring this up is in your state and many states, as you know, there is a shortage, for example, of minority physicians right now, that people are not getting into med school at the numbers we'd like to see in your state and many others, and particularly minority males. And one of the reasons, even when they have grades, is that the test scores are not high enough, quite frankly, because there's a correlation between the admissions test and what happens on board exams later on. There's a relationship between the test scores, the MCAT, and the SAT. And so the more we can do to help children in middle school and high school, and all the way down to pre-K, to learn to read and think, the better off they will be. And so those skills are so important. But congratulations to you, David, on caring so much about those young people in the way that my UMBC faculty do, and on having such high expectations.
I have a question for you, Freeman Hrabowski. Mm-hmm. Listening to David Loudy describe what he's done there at the University of Texas, Austin. Mm-hmm. You don't have a need for this at UMBC?
I think
students
the country,
come in at a higher level?
You need to understand that the country is looking at what UMBC is doing right now. We've been doing this now almost 30 years. We are leading the country. We are the only predominantly—
but, excuse me. Are you more selective at the beginning, though?
No. Our SAT is about the same as theirs, and we have a range of SATs. We have students. We have 25% of our students are Pell Grant. All right. So a lot of kids will come in who may not have had the highest SAT, who build up their backgrounds and they're able to make it. I have seen so many low-income students who've had the right attitude, who've had somebody at home who's been giving them support. They come in, they work extraordinarily hard. These are people of all races, all kinds of income backgrounds.
First in the family to go to college.
First in the family to go to college. At least 25% of my students, 25 to 30%, and they push and they push and they push and they inspire us all. That's in science. That's in literature. That's in all kinds of areas.
You need to intervene. Does the school need to intervene to make sure they graduate?
We have so much to do because they have not had the academic background.
So what do you do?
You do not. We have group work. We have collaboration, we have tutorial centers, we have student support, we have mentors, we have role models. I mean, we are constantly, in fact, we've written articles called University as Mentor. We want everyone to see themselves on that campus, all of us, as people who support these students. It's extremely important.
And what's your graduation rate?
We are up to now almost 70%. And the only reason we are as low as we are, quite frankly, is that we don't have certain academic programs because of politics in the state of Maryland. So if a student wants a business degree, for example, or electrical engineering, they have to transfer to someplace else. But other than that, the students do extremely well.
And David Loudy, 70% is your goal now at the University of Texas, Austin.
For four-year graduation rates.
And I'm talking five-year graduation rates.
You're talking 5 years.
Let me follow up on something.
Go ahead.
Talked about, the idea of feeling like you belong to a university. Students coming from these backgrounds have this uncertainty as they arrive on campus that they in fact belong. And you start to see behaviors they exhibit from the very moment they arrive that make them feel less inclined to be a part of things. So for example, you take a student who has to consider the cost of attending, and they're comparing staying in a dormitory in a residence hall with living in an apartment 20 miles away on a bus route. When they're thinking about where it is they want to get a job, and they get a job at a local restaurant instead of getting a job on campus, they are immediately put at a huge disadvantage, not just in terms of the time they spend having to work elsewhere, but the travel, and then most importantly, the disconnection. That's why that picture that you see on the cover of the New York Times Magazine is of a new program I've created called the University Leadership Network. What I did was I took students who had need and where I had discretion in the financial aid that they received, and I tied it to the relationship that they developed with the campus. Each of those students receives $5,000 a year. That's $500 at the beginning of every month, and it's done in exchange for the way in which they integrate themselves into the campus, integration through development into leadership. By the end of their first year, they've listened to motivational speakers. They've learned how to present themselves on campus. They've done service learning. They've done outreach learning. And then they find a university partner that they actually develop a mentoring and internship relationship with over the next several years. So that by the time we're through, and these are students, by the way, who really come from, there are students most at risk, are students with the greatest financial need. The intention is that 3-4 years from now, they're the ones who are student body presidents. They're the ones who are working in laboratories. Rather than having spent that first year 25 miles away from campus riding a bus, they're, as a consequence of that financial aid, on campus and feeling fully integrated right from the start.
Freeman Hrabowski?
Right. There's several things to be said. His population is very different from ours. Now, we have students from 150 countries on campus, and the students who come from Montgomery County, probably in many cases the low-income students, the Pell Grant students, are very similar to his, with a lot of kids whose parents, at least one parent, is from another country. And one of the things that Americans who've been in this country for generations may not appreciate is that many families who have parents from another country tend to be even hungrier for that success. And I don't think a lot of people appreciate what that hunger means. We see it every day. There's an intensity there that is very helpful. It is what we've seen throughout the 20th century in America, quite frankly. When you look at Nobel laureates in our country, many in the 20th century came from European countries and grew up in New York and went to the poor man's Harvard, City College, or Brooklyn College, and families where parents didn't even speak English well, and yet they had that hunger, and it made all the difference in the world. Well, we see that now among many first-generation Americans. They are bringing that great hunger, which is wonderful. We should be inspired by that. But one of our challenges in our country, and in certain parts, for example, in Baltimore right now, is that we have families who've been there for generations, and sometimes there's not as much hope. And so what we're working to do with children sometimes when they've been here for generations is to work to find ways to give those children the hope that they need so that they can develop the reading skills, the thinking skills, and the sense of self, those developmental qualities, to have the persistence, the resilience, the willingness to listen to advice, because those kinds of things are so important. And that's why it's important for universities to be very involved in K-12. And to be involved in supporting teachers in these kinds of initiatives in the Baltimore area. Because the Baltimore area or Maryland will be different from a Texas, will be different from a New York, but we can learn from each other in different kinds of ways. What I am very excited about at UMBC is that we see some of both. We have worked to bring in children from Baltimore, to have kids that we work with, our choice program that you know about, right, with first-time offenders, for example, to give them support, but also to bring people from Montgomery County, which are much more similar to some of the kids that he's gotten, and to produce what we like that's really special about the UMBC story right now is that here's this predominantly white situation, the only predominantly white institution in the country that's in the top 10 in producing blacks who go on to get PhDs and MD-PhDs in science and engineering. We're the only one, according to the National Academy of Sciences, in the top 10, which means that other institutions are still trying to figure out how to do that. And when you look at Hispanic institutions—
I thought you were actually leading the nation.
We do lead the nation with
minority African-Americans who go to graduate school.
Who get PhDs in science and engineering. And what's interesting is when you look for Hispanics, the top three institutions are the University of Puerto Rico, for example. I mean, and you get when you get beyond those institutions, I mean, you're going down to very small numbers.
What does that look like in Texas, David? A little insight on that.
Well, certainly the state of Texas is changing demographically, and it will be majority-minority before you know it. I think what we are seeing happening at UT is that as a consequence of that demographic shift, we're starting to see the population of Hispanic students rise. We are currently at about 28% minority student. It's about 24% Hispanic, 5% African, African American. And those numbers are almost certainly going to grow as a consequence of the changing population. But there's an interesting tension in all of this because UT is becoming increasingly competitive, and increasingly the mechanisms by which you can find yourself in are delivering to the school the kind of student that the president was talking about, the students who have a certain hunger for an ability to achieve these kinds of goals. The thing that I'm most interested in on the other side of their matriculation, and I'd like to hear the president's perspective about this, is that, and this is what I'd like to hear about that's happening at UMBC, is the perspective that the faculty have about their relationship with the student. To me, the great tragedy is the idea that you would take a young man or woman who has been nurtured through 18 years of being raised and educated, deposited on a campus, and then within the first few weeks feeling so out of place that they end up wanting to leave. And what is almost so often responsible for this is the way that they're evaluated academically. I don't know what's happened in our country that we've gotten to a place where faculty are assessors more so than they are teachers. And yet that's something of what we've become.
Let's hear from Freeman. Okay, I'd like to hear from Freeman Hrabowski on that.
Right, but just one quick comment
ahead,
about
David.
That. Yep. The idea that a student can break up with his girlfriend on a Thursday night and as a consequence get an F on a calculus test the next morning, that just doesn't seem right. And yet that's the structure we have in place.
David, let me commend you for caring about students. I mean, Texas Austin is very fortunate to have you in a state, quite frankly, that's known for being extraordinarily conservative, as you know. And the fact that you care so much about all types of students is very commendable.
He is in Austin, Freeman. Yeah.
I understand that, but it is, you know, quite frankly, and you know exactly what I'm saying.
Yes.
But let me just say that what makes my colleagues as a community so special is that it is a culture in which professors do really struggle with this question of how can we be most effective in giving support to students of all types, in expecting the most, yes, in expecting them to work really hard, but in understanding the challenges that they face, not because they're going to be excuses, but because it's the human experience. And across disciplines, in the social sciences and the humanities, and in getting students involved in the challenges, the sticky issues of Baltimore, for example. So large numbers of our students are involved in community service, not just as co-curricular activities, but in their classroom experiences, from history to digital arts, and in working with children and with issues. And as a result, faculty and students really are connecting. And the more they connect, as you know, the more engaged the students are, the more likely the students are to succeed. It's an unusual situation.
Okay, we'll take a break here then. We'll come back 410-662-8780. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, looking at the achievement gap, the college graduation gap, the difference between, you know, entering college as a freshman to four-year school and actually getting a diploma. UMBC President Freeman Hrabowski joining us for this conversation, along with David Laudy at the University of Texas, is a chemistry professor, but now serves also as a senior vice provost for enrollment and graduation management down there because of a program he developed to get more kids to graduate, at least, first of all, to get them through your chemistry class. And then after that, I need to ask about financial pressure. We hear a lot about that today.
Yes.
Because the cost of college has gone up considerably, especially at the private schools and also at the state universities. But let's talk a little bit about this pressure. A student gets into college, and then after a couple of years, things happen, things get tighter, they're not able to afford to get through. How do you see that at the University of Texas? David, what's your experience there with that?
Well, certainly the cost of education is going up because the cost of everything is going up. I think that for students in particular, as they show up on campus, the challenge they face is in sorting out exactly how to most smartly, most intelligently go about spending the money to get their education. And I think this is one of the ways in which students coming from disadvantaged backgrounds are in fact at a disadvantage. They really don't know the best way to go about getting the education they need for the money that they have. That's why the work that goes into assisting students and their families to understand ways to spend the money they have most wisely is important. It's also important that there be a match of a student with a university where he or she is most likely to be able to graduate. One of the challenges we face here at UT is that there will be some students who are given automatic admission, and yet you can see statistically that their likelihood of graduating is not going to be as high as it is for others. They need to be considering that and considering other schools where they might be more likely to graduate and weigh the two of those, because really there's only one thing worse than flunking out of college. It's flunking out of college and carrying substantial debt with you when you do that.
Right.
And yet the challenge there is, who's going to teach this to an 18-year-old coming from a family that is not aware of the cost of going to college? When I first went to college, my father wasn't certain about the difference between what a loan and a grant was, and he wasn't able to use that information in making wise decisions on my behalf. And I know that that's the way it is for students going to college today as well.
David is absolutely right. We need much more information that's not just available, but that is something we talk about, not just with the 18-year-old or with returning students, but with families so they can understand. We know that for-profits, for example, are taking up about a third of the debt, $1 trillion of debt. A third is going with for-profit institutions,
yeah,
where the graduation rates are lower than any place else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and they are much more expensive than most places. It's a real problem. It really is. Most people don't realize that community colleges provide an excellent education at a price that's much lower, and you move from the community college to the four-year institution, and you can do extremely well. People don't know about the quality of different kinds of institutions. So we need families to have the opportunity through schools and community groups to learn more about different types of settings, of academic settings, what the costs are, and how they can go about applying for money. One of the big challenges, for example, in Baltimore, but around the country, is that people don't get a chance to apply in time. You don't apply for a Pell Grant in July to start in September. But people don't know that. I'm seeing young people right now trying to get money for college. We actually talk about people applying by Valentine's Day in order to have it processed so they can have the money by July in order to begin in late August. But those deadlines are not things that a lot of families are accustomed to adhering to.
Let's go back to the phone lines and try again to get our listeners on the air. Mike, thank you for holding. Mike's in Anne Arundel County to make a point with us. Hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to applaud both of you for your efforts to improve success rates. And I'm happy to hear the emphasis on resources and access. I think you've nailed the key to success, really, that the high-achieving students already get and understand. Like, especially in the sciences, to get the A's, we have a child who's down at College Park. He accesses the online resources. He hits every study group that's offered. He takes advantage of the tutoring. And that translates into A's. And he's already smart to begin with. But if he didn't do all of that extra work, he wouldn't get the A that he wants. So by giving permission to the kids that are first-timers, you know, they come from almost like a sink-or-swim environment. And it's hard to get, you know, to ask for help. And I think by relentlessly promoting the resources that they need to access, you are totally on the right track. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just wanted to commend you both for doing that.
Mike, thank you for holding to make that point. I wanted to ask David Laudy a question about that. You have we mentioned before this automatic admission in Texas if you finish in the top 7% of your high school graduating class. So those students must feel pretty good about themselves when they get to campus. They think they can pull it off, and then it must be quite shocking to realize that they're not as maybe not as smart, not as good as the other kids, not up to speed as the other students. So then this comes to asking for help that they never had to ask for before when they were in high school. It must be shocking for them.
Yes, this is actually a very interesting and pivotal time, and I'm sure at UMBC it's the same thing that has to be considered. Those first few weeks on a college campus, weeks when from the perspective of a faculty member, you might be delivering your lectures and getting ready to give your test. You give the test. Most of the students do well. Some do badly. It doesn't occur to you that among those students who do badly, that this may be the first time this has ever happened to them. And where for students coming from advantaged backgrounds, they can have a phone call home and they will talk to somebody who's been to college who will say, don't worry, these things happen, it's going to sort out, or where they have a peer group that they can talk to that can help them. For a student who's a first-generation student, a student who's not accustomed to this, where there is no support structure, you really feel like you're floundering. That's why every program that we use, and I think every successful program anywhere in the country, is on top of those students day after day after day. So they're continuously aware, whether it's through a mentor, through a tutor, through an advisor, through a faculty member, of how that student is feeling and encouraging them to understand that what they're going through is a process that's going to lead to success, but one in which they have to be able to adjust along the way. But you can't just throw the switch, give a test, and not have helped to prepare the student for what's coming.
David is absolutely right. We have very structured sessions and programs for all first-year students, from students who are, most freshmen live on campus anyway, but living learning floors to freshman seminars to sessions, focus groups to constantly see how they're doing to, I mean, they have big brothers and big sisters all over campus. They are people who are watching everything that's going on to give them that support, especially in the first 6 weeks. And most important, we have redesigned first-year work. This is a cross-discipline so that we're not just lecturing to them. They are working in groups. They're getting to know each other. And what's amazing about it is the faculty get to know much more about those students much sooner.
Al, in Baltimore.
I just wanted to,
go ahead, David.
I want
to take another call here.
Yeah, just real fast. What the president says, I think, is key. Having that faculty willingness to be a part of this process is what I think really distinguishes the efforts at UMBC.
Okay. I appreciate that, Dave. You got to come visit us sometimes. I mean, we would love to have you over there. You're our kind of person.
This is Al in Baltimore. He's also been holding. Go right ahead, Al.
Yeah, good afternoon, Dan, David, and Freeman. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I agree with everything that's been said so far, and I have to advocate for the group work and dynamics development there as being involved in the academic community over the past several years. I'd like to reference that there's one area that has not been touched on, or one topic, and that is the development of social skills, especially in minority students. A lot of the minority students coming in from high school are extremely accomplished, but they may come from a lone wolf paradigm of studying. They're maybe ostracized by their own peer group that, oh, you're the smart guy, you think you're going to college, etc. And there's a very nice book, the author is Tina Rosenberg, and the title of the book is Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World.
Okay, Al, thank you. I would think that a student, though, who is singled out like that, the lone wolf, as he calls them, by the time they get on campus, then they're in the company of other lone wolves.
Well, I mean, his point was well taken, that there are, depending on the circumstances of the student, depending on the kind of high school the student attended, that could be the case. Yeah. But many students have not necessarily developed the social skills because of the technology we have. It's very easy to communicate almost completely using the technology. So one of the things we were working to do is to make sure all of our students are learning to communicate also face-to-face. It is very important to learn to talk to people, to learn how to write and to speak and to work in a group.
Right.
I mean, he's absolutely right. So while that is true for some minority students, it's true for students in general.
Here's Joe in Baltimore with a comment for us. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. First of all, Dave, let me really congratulate you. I think I'd like to send my students to your school. So I'm ready to do that. As a county school teacher and an adjunct college professor, a couple of concerns. My biggest concern is we are matriculating high school students who do not have basic skills. At CCBC, more than 70% of the incoming freshmen must take remedial math or English skills. They're not prepared. And at that particular level, it depends so much on the willingness of the instructor to give those students, and very often that doesn't happen. So how do you see this problem of students graduating from high school that are unprepared?
Okay.
So this is Dave Lotti. Mm-hmm. We saw this very specifically in the STEM fields and with math. And what we were watching was that the non-passing rates of our students in calculus were actually going up, even as the purported quality of our students was going up. What was happening was the disconnect between what was being taught in the K-12 environment and what we were expecting. It was our responsibility to reach back out. In some cases, we did it through college readiness efforts in the summer, but increasingly it's by developing the relationships with the high school so that the handoff between the two is what it needs to be. High schools are continuing to try to produce a better and better quality student that they define on the basis of AP credit earned or of an ever sophisticated level of course instruction, but the basics tend to be lost. The ability to do simple algebra isn't there.
Sure. I mean, David, your answer about the connecting of universities and school systems is a very important one. The fact is that throughout the country, looking at the performance of the majority of America's students coming out of high school, we will see that about half are ending up having to start with developmental work, whether it's in Texas or in Maryland, and that is a challenge. It really is, in reading and mathematics, and has everything to do, and that developmental set of skills in reading and math will go back to middle school work. And so we have a lot of work to do. In Texas and Maryland, there's no state that can say it has solved that problem. We do have to work on it. I think some of our universities are better off because the students we get are better prepared than that, quite frankly. And that's the problem we have in America. You've got two Americas. You've got, even among low-income kids, you've got some who are well enough prepared they can come and do well.
Mm-hmm.
So we are working with those.
And get financial aid.
Yeah, get financial aid and do well. And so we are working with those students. But there's a bigger issue than that, which has to do with all these other kids, which the teacher's talking about. Whom the teacher's talking about, and she's absolutely right, who are going to a lot of places who still can't read well, who still need a lot of work with math. And I do think it will take culture change in America. It will take all of us, from those students, families, and teachers and leaders, focusing on those issues, because it's about American competitiveness, and it's about whether or not those students will be able to develop the skills in order to get jobs and take care of their families.
I want to thank Freeman Hrabowski for being here today. Freeman Hrabowski, of course, the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, with no plans to move on to another position that we know of.
Listen, UMBC is by far the best place in the universe
really?
To be.
For, no
we
plans.
Were just named
okay.
best one of the best colleges to work for right. in the country.
No big offers to take on another position.
It's an
position.
Amazing place. Ask my students
I
and colleagues.
I can't resist asking you. Every time he comes here, David Lotti, I have to
don't you
to
see
ask
the
him.
Smile on my face? Yeah, it's because I'm so happy to be there.
David Lotti, continue good luck with your program at the University of Texas Austin. We appreciate you being on the show to describe it for us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And Texas is a fine state for both liberals and conservatives.
David, come visit UMBC. You're our kind of guy. Congratulations to you.
David Lowdy, Senior Vice Provost for Enrollment and Graduation Management at the University of Texas at Austin. You can read more about him in that cover story that appeared in the New York Times Magazine in May. There's a link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Freeman Hrabowski, always a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to our first hour of Midday Today. Lunch for our guests provided by Apples and Oranges Fresh Market, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Its catering menu includes deli and sandwich platters, fruit, cheese plates, and desserts. Apples and Oranges Fresh Market is open daily up on North Broadway, 1900 North Broadway. More information at applesandorangesmarket.com.